Welcome to Thinking Deeply by Primary Education, the podcast that makes time and space to think about pedagogy, teaching and learning, professional development, anything of interest to time-poor but enthusiasm-rich primary teachers. This week, I'm joined by Lloyd Williams-Jones.
Hello there.
And together, we're going to explore establishing a belief in the academic potential of all pupils. But first, Lloyd, what's you reading for?
Hey, what you reading for?
So this week, and over the last couple of weeks really as well, I have been reading a document that Kent County Council produced, which the local authority produced, which is called the Mainstream Core Standards. Now, this is a document which serves to support teachers and staff in Kent with supporting children who have special educational need or further need in education. And it's actually an excellent document, which goes through all the four main areas of SEND need. And it goes through some really excellent practical advice around supporting children with specific need. Now, it's not an area my expertise, I'll be honest. And it's something that I always know I try to work hard to further myself in widening my perspectives and trying to go a bit deeper around how to really ensure that we support children with SEND. And this document is superb. It's an absolutely superb piece of work. And from my understanding, there are not many other local authorities in the country that have this. Kent are actually way ahead of the game on this, because I think with the Green Paper, they suggested that local authorities are, you know, and provisioning across England were to create, or there was going to be some sort of creation of a document of this ilk to support schools with provision on the ground. Now, we know it's a slightly hot, contested topic at the moment, isn't it, around SEND in schools and how schools are being supported to deal with more challenging need. And this document is an excellent way of doing it. It's freely available. So, you know, you don't have to be in Kent to access it. You just Google Mainstream Core Standards, Kent. You'll get hold of this document very freely available as a PDF. It's about sort of 50, 60 pages, but it is a stonker of a document. And we work through it. We have it as a running agenda on our SLT meeting every week. And we look at an area of it every week. So we keep SEND high profile and we keep it at the forefront of what we're doing in schools and the part of it integrated as part of our practice. Kieran, what are you reading for?
Nice. That sounds excellent. And it's great to hear that they're ahead of the curve. Makes a delightful change. And so I'll definitely check it out. And I reckon school leaders with similar preoccupations will do too. Nice. It's a bit of a purple patch for education books at the minute. Responsive Coaching by the one and only Josh Goodrich. It's
jealous.
Yeah, I mean, I can send it across to you whenever I finish, because I'm going to finish it very quickly. And it's an excellent guide to anyone who's interested in coaching and really getting under the skin, but in a very practical way. So well worth checking out, because we know that Josh thinks really deeply about coaching. And this is a fine distillation. I think he was getting stick about how long it took him to write, but it was definitely worth the wait.
He has been writing that a long time. Like, I was speaking to him a couple of years back when he was like, oh, I'm going to write. So I do understand where the stick comes from. But hey, good things come to those who wait, right? And I think that is going to be probably up there with some of the seminal texts, certainly around coaching, because he knows his onions, does Josh.
So we're going to explore a belief in all pupils. What does a belief in the academic potential of all pupils mean to you?
I guess it fits quite neatly with what you're reading for there at the start. It's that word all that I focus on there is the really most important part of things. And I feel like, and dare I say it, some of the, you know, we've had a massive shift, haven't we, in the literature and the research and the engagement with this stuff over the last couple of years. And it's been fantastic. And the profession has benefited greatly from it. But for me, this does seem to be a little bit lacking in, you know, when we think of that word all, some of the literature and how that fits to children with SEND and children who have specific need. You know, when we think of the bottom 20% in our classrooms, often these children fall into that category. And there are some voices who are doing excellent work, like Cassie, for example. I know she's been on. She is a stupendous voice on SEND. But I feel like we need to really think carefully about how that applies to all. And when I say all, I mean all children, you know, because yes, of course, the principles of, you know, cognitive science and research informed teaching, they're fantastic, you know, they drive what we do, but there has to be caveats and there has to be considerations for all children. And I think in order, and that serves to then make sure that children are able to reach their potential. So when we consider what we mean, we need to widen our lens a little bit. That's how I feel. We need to widen the lens a little bit and think, right, yeah, okay, so great, retrieval practice or whatever it is, or interleaving or space practice or whatever it is, great, they're great principles. But have we thought about how that works, for example, for a child who's working perhaps not on the same curriculum as their peers in the classroom? How does that work for them? Have we considered their potential and how they move from point A to point B? Now, I think how we recognize that is actually micro, in my opinion. Is how we recognize tiny steps of success. That's what recognizing potential in all children is for me. It's like, how do I see how to move this every single child in this class on a bit every day? And that, you know, and that for the mass is normally, you know, we've got, I feel like we're getting better at that on our practice and our instruction. Great. But also, how would those children with specific need, are we really catering for them and making sure that those little wins, those little 1% are coming home, because they feel the 1% in the same way that the rest of the class do. It's just in their own context. So for me, that's how I interpret that question. That's how I interpret that potential for all is it's actually through small success. That's kind of my short take on it, if you will.
In my experience, and I think this will relate to yours as well, because we worked in similar contexts and similar sort of catchment areas, you've almost got two groups. You've got those people who do have a specific diagnosable need, and you've got those kids who have low prior attainment, but perhaps low engagement when they're very young, gaps in their learning, but then get considered to have something that is diagnosable, but it's probably not. It's a paucity of the high quality instruction that you've just outlined. How do you go about identifying those pupils who, you know, because I think it's a very small percentage of the population at large who actually have those really profound needs. How do you go about identifying the difference? Because high quality teaching in many instances will be sufficient for those kids who have had that positive experience. But obviously, there will be those people who do need something different. What's your decision making process like?
Yeah, that is spot on, actually. And you picked up on something there that I failed to mention. Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's also that group of children who get like put into the SEND group, if you will, that don't have SEND as such, that are just academically significantly behind their peers for whatever reasons. You know, we have a lot of travelers in our community who are quite transient and will miss large parts of their schooling. So, but it's not necessarily that they, you know, they can't do something. It's just they haven't reached that point yet. I suppose that's the same with a lot of children, isn't it? Really, it's like anybody, you haven't reached the point yet, have you? But you know, how the identification of those children, I think, comes through our process in our place, and I'm sure this is similar to in most schools. Is, you know, through robust kind of pupil progress discussions and through your kind of formative and summative assessment that you do in a day-to-day basis, you know, and you know, you ask any teacher, they know who those children are, right? it's what we do with those children that is the most important thing, isn't it? It's like, yes, okay, so we've identified them. We know they've got significant need. What do they need to maximize their potential? Now, this is where now we've got to be like really careful about hot housing, narrowing curriculums and things. We've got to really keep that balance between, you know, models. And I know Max Wayne talks about this previously, you know, how we, you know, we took inspiration from him, and we use the obviously the same day intervention model, which is superb for those children in terms of giving them that extra bit of time to work with the expert, the teacher, to have that extra bit of intervention. And then it's about maximizing all the other times in the day that you can to support them to be successful. Again, going back to that successful, so you're maximizing their potential as much as you can. Because, you know, if we're being realistic, we are limited by the time that we have every day. You know, we can only do so much in a day. And I think being real about this as well is important. That's not to say we're lowering our ambitions. It's just we need to be realistic about what we can achieve. And again, it's about, and I say that word achieve, link back to that success, them feeling successful, leading to motivation, leading to, you know, reaching potential. So tapping into that precision teaching, you know, on a daily basis. Now we're looking to really shift on our precision teaching, because that is a strategy. It's obviously a 10 strategy, but it's just a strategy for all children as well, in terms of short, quick, it's retrieval essentially, isn't it? You know, it's short, quick bursts of, you know, it can be high frequency words, it can be bonds, it can be whatever it is that that child has gaps in, and trying to track that. And we use Insight. Insight's a tremendous data tracking tool, because it can track literally whatever you want. So getting that, we're moving to integrate our systems even further and move all our kind of send stuff onto there. But also with those children that you just mentioned, they're identified on that system as well. And then we're able to see the small wins with them as well. Because often what we don't get with them in terms of reaching potential is we don't see the big grade changes so quickly, do we? You know, in terms of like working at the expected standard for their age group or not. You know, that is a big jump, isn't it? When we cross that threshold to the expected standard. It's all the stuff in between that is the nuts and bolts of what shifting learning on is all about. So having those robust systems around like identification through your pupil progress, through your discussions with teachers, we do like a mentoring sort of approach this year, which has been fantastic. So I've been mentoring our year five team. I know exactly, and they know exactly who those children are and what the provision is for those children. So it's about being really robust and not sweeping anything under the carpet, or like you said, sweeping them into a group with SEND when they perhaps don't have SEND. I think we can't, you know, we've got to be honest about that. We can't say that they do when they don't, you know, and I think like the misdiagnosing it, you know, we're not professional medical professionals or whatever, but we do have a pretty good working knowledge of our children when we're in the classroom. So yeah, that's sort of our processes around it.
I mean, when teachers, I mean, often they'll be at their wit's end and they ask me, what do I do with this pupil? And I will say to them, you need to have as robust a picture as possible. And actually, something like Insight, and they've made loads of changes recently, haven't they? Is that's a really good way to capture that data, because anyone making some sort of decision, whether it's an educational psychologist or a medical professional, the more robust a picture you can paint for them, the more accurate they can possibly be. Because I know that the younger the pupils are, the more difficult it is actually to make any kind of medical diagnosis, isn't it?
Very much so. And I think, like you said, the Insight they've brought a load of new features in recently, which I would highly recommend you considering looking at their services if you're not already sort of subscribe to them. But yeah, in terms of that, it's that, like I think Jamie Pembroke said it, didn't he? It's like it's the signal through the noise, you know, because we know that this noisy data points we collect can be noisy, qualitative or quantitative, whatever we pick, it can be noisy, and we've got to establish what's working, what's moving, and how the child feels about it all as well. You know, go back to this potential. I think you've got to be really clear about narrating your potential as well. We'll probably come onto that in a later question now. But how you capture that mentality as a school around your personal development is really key as well. Like that whole, until this year, I didn't quite realize how important I've been, like I said, I've mentioned a previous episode, I've been working on personal development this year, and it's a big area of the, it's, you know, it's one of the key Ofsted areas. And I can see why, because it is, it's so good to support children in that kind of realizing that they can do something. And I'm not necessarily talking growth mindset here, like, you know, I know, but I think there's a power in being really clear about your vision as a school and your purpose and the children, that being communicated to children and children sharing in that with you, because it does shift the culture of the school. And that's what, you know, fundamentally, when we want to shift anything, we want to shift culture. And that comes from this core sort of tenet of personal development.
As school leaders, how can we create the conditions for all pupils to achieve well?
Right. How long have you got? So that's a massive question. You could take this down so many different avenues, couldn't you? Like, it's such a broad question. But in terms of the, I sort of think of that question as in terms of access, and not only access, but I'll go back to what I said earlier about how a child's moved from A to B in a day, in a week, in a month, in a term, right? And that if we think about it from that level, what do our teachers really, really consider the provision that is in place to do that? Or, you know, and I've seen this previously, I've been guilty of it probably in the past as well. Are we paying lip service to, you know, adaptive teaching? It's what I call performative adaptive teaching. Like where we tick a box to say, look, we've got these six things, we've got widget and we've got digit and digit and whatever you're going on, right? And yes, okay, they're all, you know, all these different techniques and tools and things, but do they work? Do they have you asked the child, does this help them? Does this actually move them from A to B? Or does this just look like, to a stakeholder, you're catering for the bottom 20%? But for me, that is the crux of how do we ensure that we cater for all? Like, it's drilling down and being honest and reflective with, and it can be uncomfortable, like, and having those conversations. But if you create the right culture and climate in your school, where you can have those conversations, you can challenge each other, and you can say, right, I know you've worked hard, you know, I know you've like thought about this and you've made this resource, or you've considered this provision. Is it working? You know, when we get to those discussions in people progress, or when we do our mentoring, or when we do our instructional coaching, or whatever it is whatever mechanism you choose to be supporting the development of staff and development of children, it's about being completely frank and saying, you know, are we genuinely seeing progress here? And then that, you have to triangulate that by talking to the child, looking at the books, having a look around, doing some coaching, seeing some teaching, and then considering a decision. And I've just alluded to it, and I know how complex that is when we have to make those decisions, because it's difficult to do. We know that as leaders, it's tricky to get a really clear read on something, because I think, you know, we said, go back to what Dylan Williams said, you need 10, well, I can't remember, I quote really roughly, what was it, 10 teachers across 3 years observing a gazillion hours or whatever to get some semblance of whether a teacher is good or not. You know, that aside, the practicalities and the reality of the job is, you know, is this helping? And I think if you can get that answered, you're not going to go far wrong, because you will have done the necessary work and had the necessary conversations to put in place the best provision that you can offer in your setting. And I think, like, I'll take a current example. We've got like a really sort of big priority on writing, as I'm sure most schools have. Post pandemic, writing has taken a massive hit, and it's really challenging to try and pull back up some of these year groups who are really deeply affected by the pandemic. And we've been working super hard. And I know, like, if you've seen Andrew Percival's talk on his writing curriculum, I know that obviously Neil came from work Neil had done Steph and things. You know, that sentence-based, really kind of granular approach of like sort of going sequential and step by step and breaking it down, which is great. That's the, that kind of thinking, going back to the core purposes of writing, really, and grammar supports children to be successful, and it's that kind of approach. So, like we when we're thinking about when we've been thinking about trying to support our some of our bottom 20% writers and trying to think about how they are accessing things. We've been working on really hard, and we've got another training coming up after the Easter holidays on our part of our professional development pathway around scaffolding and particularly fading, because and I've talked about this before. Again, when we look at that bottom 20%, when we look at how we provision for all children, how we make sure that all potential is achieved, well, the only way that happens in writing is if we know we have to put support in for those children, we have to put scaffolding in. We've been using things like substitution frames where they pick the correct word to form a sentence, but all of, it's all given to them. And then but what we haven't quite nailed yet, and this is where our next piece of training is coming in, is how that fading happens then out of it. Because ultimately, that's a support. That's, you know, that's scaffolding that we want to remove. And it's the removing of the scaffolding that is the most important part, isn't it? So how then they move from that substitution frame, I can share those later with you if people haven't heard of them, then into sort of a substitution frame, but with some close elements in it, into the next sentence being a sentence starter, and then being finally a sentence they write independently. So that structure of fading is bedded into ensuring that children feel success. And what we've had is two things. We've seen early, like I've been working with a teacher to do this, and I've seen firsthand the impact that's had. There's two reasons. One, well, three really. One, children feel success because they're like, where they really struggle to write sentences perhaps in the past, or they're just doing a worksheet with a closed procedure on it, or they're doing something that has been like, they're actually moving to getting to the part of the end of the lesson and be like, look, I just wrote that sentence. That's my sentence. You know, they have an ownership over the success as well, which is fantastic. Two, the teacher allows a level of independence in those children, which we famously know you could spend the whole lesson with every day, all the time. They need to experience independence. And that's like one of our school values as well, you know, in terms of like how that links to that, and how teachers then narrate that independence to the children and say, you've done that on your own. You've got off and you've done that bit and you've written your own sentence. Next time we're going to try and do two. And like, you know, it's those small incremental things building bit by bit by bit, the 1%. That's what, and I know it's just one area of the curriculum, and you could talk about it in maths, fading in maths as well works beautifully. But I do think that is a big, for me, it's a big ticket item, fading. And I think I've not given that enough thought in the last couple of years of my teaching. And I actually think that is a significant part of how we ensure success for all children. And like I said, and allowing that teacher the freedoms to go and, you know, ensure that all of the class are supported, children feel independent, and they feel success. So that's just a little case study story, like of how we thought about how all children in writing are being supported through the necessary provision. But again, we haven't quite got it right yet. We're still thinking about how we make that better, how we consider, you know, what they need. It's that magic question then of how much do you fade? When, how early do you fade it? How long do you need? You know, we were talking about whether, so when we were looking at, when they were writing a paragraph, having that structure, substitution table, having a closed procedure bit, then into a sentence. And then what we were originally doing is going, right, now try writing the next paragraph on your own. And it was like, no, it's too much. It's cognitive overload again. So we then repeated the same pattern again. We decided, right, back to the substitution frame. And then and we go again, you know, so they don't then fall off a cliff. They get taste of success again. But that maybe then at the end of the second sort of paragraph, they have two sentences that they write on independently, you know, and it's that sort of micro level of provision that I think ensures and discussion and honesty that ensures that all children's potential is sort of maximized.
Neil and Thomas at STEP built in some sort of fading or an element of fading into their curriculum structure. So you'll have the granular grammatical element, And then you will also have almost like this four, maybe sometimes five step journey through each of them. So I think it starts with just recognizing the phenomenon. So say you're looking at, I don't know, subordinate clauses. You would just be identifying the subordinate clause or the subordinate sort of conjunction. Then it would be using it, I think. Then it might be identifying it in a paragraph or where it's not in a paragraph, and then using it in a very short paragraph. And so over this, over a series of lessons, you will have had repeated exposure. So I don't know if that might be worth exploring for anyone who is interested in exploring that idea. And also Amy Bills, a long time ago, asked me to elaborate on when the scaffold comes down in maths, because she thought that it was something that wasn't discussed enough. So actually there's a video, I think it's maybe 20, 25, 30 minutes long on our Ko-fi, where I actually go into a four-step plan. And that's relevant because in a recent blog I wrote about flexible grouping, I said one of the key points was the routines and the structures in place from the school are one of the safeguards for making sure that flexible grouping doesn't become absolute chaos. I'm assuming from what you're saying that you're going to codify fading. Have you codified lots of those different elements of, you know, you talk, I mean, I think that phrase performative adaptive teaching is fantastic, and you know, copyrighted right here. All those different elements of being adaptive. Have you guys codified for your teachers so they're supported by the structures in place from the school?
That's the aim. So like we've started the work on that. Very much, like I said, very much supported as well by the mainstream course standards. They've codified a lot of things in there, which is, again, I signpost back to the thing I said at the start, which is great. It's a great place to start. But like we know, like anything, like you said, it's always best to personalize and contextualize the work that you do to your setting. So yeah, in respect of, like I've said this before, about how we do when we do training, you know, how you follow that up with a here's the guide to how we, you know, or it's built into the policy, or you know, the writing policy is like under the provision and support and fading section. And I think that's something that is a long-term consideration, which is that we have like a fading section in kind of all of the different policies, and what fading looks like in geography, what it looks like in maths, what it looks like in English. And I think, because I honestly do believe that is significant in how we move children on, how children get better and independent at learning. So that coupled with then videoing your training that you do on Zoom, you know, so any PDE you deliver, capturing that so that it's always there to go back to, so there for new staff for induction as well, if they need to come in and see what we mean by that. And I think the gold standard, we haven't got there yet, the gold standard is to back that up with another video of somebody doing it in your setting with your children. I think, and I know Sonia Thompson, I think, does this. They do it in their school, which is like, it's something that I am extremely jealous about, and something I want to work towards is that codification in a sense of like with real life examples. I know like StepLab have excellent videos on their if you use their for coaching, and I know that the Career Framework have exemplar videos and things. I think teachers seeing what it looks like and feels like, particularly in their setting and their routines, is so powerful. So that's the work I would like to do going forward. But I would, yeah, if schools can do that, capture those things, have somebody who leads on compiling the centralized library that is available on SharePoint, that is available off wherever you want to watch it, you know, I think that is, there's an immense power in that, because what you can do as well is you can revisit those videos that I'm teaching and narrate over them and pause them and things and say, you know, and I think that, you know, we talk about metacognition in terms of supporting children, but it also supports adults. So, you know, where we could stop, pause and say, right, at this point I was thinking this and I did this because X, Y, you know, it's just, there's just such power in that. And yes, that's the grand plans. We're not there yet, but that is the idea, I think, going forward.
If you are a Microsoft school, I think one of the apps that you get is actually is somewhere you is like a video repository. Because I remember before I finished my last project, I put everything I'd done somewhere for them for their induction, and it was I can't remember the name, but it had like a pink sort of picture for the app. And
Yeah, I think I know the one. I've seen it. I don't know. I've clicked on it. It's the end of the Office 365 suite, isn't it? Yeah,
yeah.
in the yeah.
And you can add collections. You can see as a person who's recorded them
Oh,
how many
nice.
people have viewed it. So like I put all our early years training on there. So it was the framework had changed at the time. So we had three videos going through the key changes and what this meant for teachers. And then I could see when the early years team engaged with it because we had a follow-up meeting about what have you know, because flex, I think it was pretty much mid-pandemic. So we needed to be flexible in terms of when we engage with this. I will try and put it in the show notes or the even the description underneath if I can find out the name. But it's certainly for me, you know, it's almost you could have different groups of videos and stuff. It's almost like it's all done for you. Whereas if you're a Google Scholar, any other, you know, other things are available. I'm sure. I don't think there's a comparable outside of just having folders, you know. So it's pretty cool. You can sequence it and you can add forms in. So that there's a
Oh,
quiz
nice.
after every one. So I would have okay, what were your key takeaways from this? Or and then maybe even later on have like a retrieval quiz about the key sort of thing. So you can really go next level, but you probably need someone doing that full time
Yeah.
to you know, because I'm pretty sure I did a lot of this when I wasn't allowed in classes because of bubbles. So when you've been teaching, you've been working with pupils who I think it's fair to say have experienced repeated failure over a number of years. How do you approach getting them to believe in themselves?
Yeah, so I'll go back here to again. You know, we talked about those. You know, I've already talked about those small steps of success, so like tiny little wins to build. We know from Peps's work. Just read Peps's motivation book. I mean, that will give you everything you need to know on motivation and how to harness it. In terms of the school sense, and part of that will be the norms, the beliefs, the culture that is in your school, and I think that's where this stuff really, really kicks in. So for me, like as it's when I was in class, I was teaching and stuff, and even now when I teach, you know, like when I'm teaching a maths group, I'm teaching readers on a daily basis. You know, I've got reluctant learners in there as well, children who find things really, really difficult. Your attitude and narration towards things is so important. Like, it's how you speak to children about learning is massive. And I think we've got to be really careful about just those little things that we can say that we don't think perhaps have a much of a would ever have much of an inference off the bat. Sorry, much of an impact off the bat. But when you actually consider it all, added in those little comments about things being hard or things being challenging or things, you know, the way, oh yeah, right, okay, let's have a go with this again, or just your every little phrase that you use with a child has an impact on them. And I think we've always got to remember that we do perform. Teachers step into a room and we perform. And even if we feel, often we feel something completely different to what we're saying, but that's part of the art of teaching, isn't it? That we are able to man, we control our output so that children receive a message from us that is really clear and is not mixed and consistent. And I think going back to that metacognition that I just talked about, I think like narrating as teachers narrating all the time. And I know Chris has talked about this previously on podcasts as well about how you can depressurize and you can, you know, when you say to children, oh yeah, I couldn't do this before, but then I, you know, but I was, but then I managed to, you know, when I couldn't do this, you know, so they know that they feel they're not alone. In perhaps they're in because that can be a lonely place in a class as a child if you're not up with your peers. And they know they're not silly, they know they recognize often around them that there's children are doing things, you know, are getting further along. And so I think being really careful to narrate that, I'll pull back up that example that Chris gave before, which was fantastic, which is like, you know. Telling them that they're doing work above the age that they're meant to, that they are actually doing, you know, it's like, oh, well, this is actually year six worth this, you know, so, you know, little things like that you can do. Narrating, like I just said there, about how you know, you couldn't do it before, but now, you know, or when I was there, trying to relate to them, because they need to feel like that you really care, that they find something hard. And then that comes back to then celebrating those wins as well, wider. So, like, again, having really strong systems and processes in your school for like pride and celebration. And I think those things, whilst yes, all right, we know realistically that, I know I think Pep says about it, you know, the long-term effects of dangling a carrot, we know that and ultimately isn't going to lead to, right, the work's going to be done, you know, this carrot will make you do this maths work or whatever, rather than them being successful. However, and I think he does allude to this, and I have talked to him about perhaps about this before, there is absolutely no harm whatsoever in a vision as a school and a celebration and a regular celebration of children and children's work. Something we've done recently as well is like, well, I hadn't done this before, and schools probably do this and been doing this for years, but like having a visualizer in your hall in your assembly, so that you put work under the visualizer so that all children can see that work, the whole assembly sees that work, you know, like not just holding it up at the front, you know, it's like really digging down into things as a school and so you're modeling that to the whole school and then drawing out like the values that you can see, like the determination and you know, resilience and narrating those concepts to children. So what they are, so they really are like bedded into what you do so that those children feel those things. And then when they get a determination award or they get it, they know what that is and they relate to it and they connect with it. So, you know, and that is only going to help children's like perception of themselves. You know, I just can't see that being a negative thing. All right, even if it's not getting the massive gains that, you know, but it's not that for me, it's not about that. It's about self-esteem. And like, I think like, that stuff builds self-esteem. It builds belonging to a community, and I think that's where if you put do you know what? I actually, as a leader, I've learned a lot about that. Like, and I didn't put enough value on that prior to sort of those last couple of years. I now see how important that is to make sure that those things are really strong in your school, because it's that sense of team, that sense of community, that sense of we think these things are important. We all think these things are important. And creating those norms is so key. And I think that is what fundamentally supports children's perceptions of themselves and their esteem and then their ability. If they feel like they feel confident about this school believes in me and I believe in the school and I believe in my teachers and I believe in this, then I'm more likely to have a go with this little question. And maybe get and hopefully get it right, because we've made it small enough that they feel a little bit success. And then okay, right, I'm going to do some more. I'm going to try, you know. And all right, yeah, they may be operating way below their peers or not near the expected standard. But then they move and they move and they move. And like I said, go back to those 1% that then all add up, and all of a sudden you've seen significant progress from them in a year because of that picture all coming together, supporting the child as a whole, the whole school supports them.
I remember watching Amarbir Singh Gill talking about some research into praise, and he said that pupils are able to sniff out, essentially, I'm really simplifying this, they could sniff out false praise. And so what you're talking about there, that you know, this is relative to the pupil, but this is really accurate about their achievement, and this is what we prioritize, I think is probably the way to tread that line. Because, if you know, it was very much a case of they knew when praise was being handed out because they were the pupils who struggled, as opposed to they had achieved something. And so I think that's, you know, what you've outlined there, you know, and having the visualizer in the hall helps you to avoid that, because, you know, you're saying, look, this is really impressive. And in particular, the fact that the group that I'm thinking about, you know, those boys, GRT boys, you were teaching to read, they're not silly. They're going to sniff out that praise quicker than anybody else, you know, or that false praise. They do not mess around, you know. They know exactly what the sort of social construct in the class is, or in, even within a group. And if this is working for them, then I think it has a really strong chance of extrapolating out across the sort of the wider pupil population, because then, you know, those boys will tell you straight, you know, exactly how things are going. I don't know, you know, you're not alone, but it, you know, in my experience, there's no messing around, I don't think.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely spot on. Yeah, very much needs to be integrated into what you do as a school. You know, it needs to, you need to live and breathe those values, and they need to be part of what you do. Now, the piece of work I've been just working on recently is very much that. We've got our pride values, we call them, and we've started working on something called our pride moments, where each one of our, like, positivity, independence, determination, like, each one of those is that we're going to set up a little sort of a award for each one of them, like a little sticker award that goes onto the book. But we've kind of we've started to codify what that would look like. So for like an independence award, giving a load of different examples to teachers about what that actually looks like. I know that sounds ridiculous. Like, it's like, oh, well, teachers should just know that off the top. But actually, unless you are explicit as a school and you say, this is something that, you know, if a child that would do this, you know, let me take an example I gave around the writing. It's not just, oh, they did a good piece of writing. It's like being really specific when you give when you give praise to a child about what it is that they've done. Like, you know, this is the thing they struggled with and they couldn't do before. They used this thing and now they've done this, and because and so they it's that kind of it's signposting exactly what they've done or what's been used or what the thing was that supported the child to get the award. That hopefully is only going to help to cement the kind of importance of the adaptation in the provision, and for the child seeing, oh, that thing really helped me. That was really good. I'm going to just keep trying to do that, you know? So I think, and then that comes back to, you know, more genuine praise rather than, because Abby is great. He's a lovely man. He's extremely well read. I'm caught up with him at a research ed back. And I haven't seen him speak yet, but I must see him speak the next one I get to. Because he's absolutely spot on there. We know what general, they will sniff it out. And particularly some of our community as well, they will sniff that out. So, I think you mitigate that by being really earnest and being really integrated and honest and sort of and genuine about your appraise and approach and specific with it as well. I think that supports that whole approach. Yeah.
We've covered a lot of ground in a short space of time. Probably revisit this at some point in the future. I've got a job for you before you go, though, Lloyd.
Oh,
We've been
yeah.
talking about getting Charisse on. You know, we're talking about the GRT community. Talking about getting Charisse
Yes.
on with you for a
Yes.
double episode. Can you take this as your next step to go off and arrange that time?
I will reach out to Sharice. I haven't spoken to her in a while, actually. I must see how she's doing. And we'll get that organized for sure.
Fantastic. Well, it has been an absolute pleasure. I really appreciate you giving me up your free time. You're now sort of free to go back to the chaos that is your front room.
Free time. No such thing. No such thing.
Absolutely not. All I say to do is say thank you very much.
Thanks, dear.
And everyone at home, until next time, thanks for listening.